United States Navy has five financial opportunities to modernize its fleet. That's according to Brian Clark, senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments, former special assistant to the Chief of Naval Operations. He was one witness at a hearing of the House Armed Services Subcommittee on Sea Power and Projection Forces. The other witness at that hearing was Brian McGrath, managing director of the Ferry Bridge Group, former director of the Navy Strategic Actions Group, and they are my guests on Pentagon Solutions today to talk about what the committee asked them, their responses, and what the committee didn't ask them. Gentlemen, thank you very much for joining me today. McGrath is joining us from San Diego, and I thank you for taking your time on the West Coast. Brian, I'll just call you by your last names, and I don't mean to be rude, gentlemen, but it's difficult with both of you being Brians. So, McGrath, I'll start with you. What was your primary message for the Sea Power and Projection Forces Subcommittee? Thanks for coming on today.
My pleasure. My primary message was that I think that surface forces have become sub-optimized in the way that we can use them in presence, deterrence, and warfighting, that we have gotten risk-averse, that we are not using them to their potential, and with some fairly focused and straightforward improvements, we could make the surface force more lethal and operate it differently in a way that creates problems for potential adversaries.
Mr. Clark, your message for the committee primarily was what?
I felt similarly that the surface Navy had been suboptimized, that it hadn't been able to gain sea control like the joint force needs it to, because we over time had reduced our ability to be able to take out threats to sea control. And so to step back a little bit, what we kind of depend on the surface Navy to do is make sure that the rest of the military is able to travel on the surface of the water and under the water when necessary, to be able to move around the world, to protect sea lanes, to go project power, to go do shows of force, things like you're seeing in the Gulf of Aden right now.
Mm-hmm.
And that's their primary job. During the Cold War, they focused on being able to do that against the Soviet threat. And in the 25 years since the Cold War ended, we had lacked a competitor for sea control and was uncontested. So you can see today off of Yemen how the United States Navy is able to drive around without too much concern about threats from shore being able to come out and reach the ships. But what's going to happen in the near future is that's not going to be the case. So countries like China, Iran, Russia, even Syria, have capabilities that might be able to keep us from being able to operate in the oceans near their shores. The surface Navy over time has not been developing the capabilities to pace that threat. So now they've become very defensive. They've had to build up the defensive capabilities to somehow survive in that environment. So instead of being able to gain control of an area of ocean for the joint force, they're forced to merely defend themselves from attacks, and they can't gain sea control in that area.
Mr. McGrath, tell me about the term suboptimized, your definition of it, and how you believe the Navy got to that situation today.
My definition of suboptimization is this. That over time, I'll give you a story. In 1987, I was commissioned in the United States Navy and was sent to my first ship. My first ship was a single-propeller, steam-driven, fast frigate. It was 15 years old, and if everybody on the ship clicked their heels together and wished upon a star, we could do one major thing right at a time. That ship could kill other ships far over the horizon with a Harpoon missile. It could hunt and eliminate Type 2 and Type 3 Soviet nuclear submarines with its both passive and active sonars and its helicopter and torpedoes. We did those jobs really, really well because the surface force that I entered in 1987 valued those things. The ship I commanded from 2004 to 2006 was a three-year-old Arleigh Burke destroyer. It was one of the three or four newest ships in the Navy at the time. It had no over-the-horizon missile system. I could not kill another ship with my ship. It had sonar systems. It had very, very sophisticated sonar systems that the Navy, to its credit, had continued to put money in. But we didn't put the same kind of money into the training of the people. We got to the point where on the frigate in 1987, I had some 35 sonar technicians. On the destroyer that I had in 2007, I had about 20. And their proficiency was dismal compared to the sonar techs that I had in the late 80s, who spent their entire careers tracking nuclear submarines. So We have a number of ships, very powerful ships, that over time, as Brian described it, because of both the change to the threat environment and because of we wanted to reap the peace dividend, we got poor at killing ships with other ships, and we got less good at finding and neutralizing submarines. So when I say the ships are suboptimized, I mean we have a lot of good ships that don't do that anymore. And in order to get the most bang for the buck out of the ships that we have, they have to become more proficient at more things. That's why I say they're suboptimized.
So I'm going to read between the lines of both your testimonies to the committee and the responses to the questions that you gave. And Mr. McGrath, your comment a moment ago kind of triggered this in my mind. Is it time for, this is a broader, more existential question than anything that you were asked too. Perhaps is it time for us, policymakers, Congress, think tank community, whatever, to consider the possibility or to confirm that maybe there is no such thing or shouldn't be any more such a thing as the peace dividend, that's how we got to where we are, and that such a concept is not a way that we should think about things anymore?
Well, I think that peace dividend was at least conceptually a reasonable thing when the wall fell, when we became the sort of sole superpower or hyperpower, whatever you want to call us. There were legitimate, rational, and appropriate changes to our defense establishment that reflected the change in threat. I think what I would say, and I think Brian would agree with me, is that the threat has changed again. We are back in a world of great power dynamics, great power contention. The military that we built to support a sustainment of our position in the world when there was no threat is inappropriate to this new world, and we have to begin to think differently.
I think if we go back to throughout the history of the highly militarized war effort in the United States, beginning with World War I, and moving forward, though, Brian Clark, we always see that there's always another change in the power dynamic. We're not always able to predict it, but we can always, or we can at least confidently predict that there'll be another one. Is that fair to say?
Definitely, definitely. What we see, too, is that perhaps these times when we're between conflicts, if we will, end up being more the exception than the rule. So between World War I and World War II in the interwar period, there was a peace dividend of sorts that was taken to some degree that may have encouraged the Nazis to rise and try to take the territory that they did. After World War II, there wasn't really the same peace dividend, but there still was one of sorts where we demobilized the force to some degree. And even as the Cold War began to ramp up, there was still some savings that were harvested by the Department of Defense. And then as the Cold War ended in the late 80s, early 90s, you know, we did reap some dividends there. But again, those interregnums between conflict end up being shorter and shorter maybe over time, and more of our time is spent in the buildup and preparation for conflict than in the peace dividend that follows.
And you could also argue, I suppose, and Mr. McGrath could jump in here if you like, you could also argue, I suppose, that in the time after World War II, we had the Korean conflict that at least kept the toe dipped right in the water as far as operational capabilities and so on. And then the stretch between the end of that and the beginning, at least, of the advisors going to Vietnam, the history then, right, you know, it presents itself on its own from that time forward. There's always been a time where the next thing was at least on the horizon,
right,
that until the late 80s, early 90s, with the downfall of the Soviet Union, there was never really a time where we were completely out of the war business for any extended period of time.
That's a great point. And as Brian brought up, what we're seeing is now, after World War II, the U.S. as a great power has a different role in the world, which had already started with World War I, but clearly after World War II, the U.S. had a role in the world that was different than its previous role. And as such, it's got to have the ability to some degree, be the not a policeman for the world, but certainly be a stabilizing power in regions around the world, which requires a degree of military capability and capacity. Otherwise, if we were to cede that, other players will then fill that vacuum, and those players may not be as interested in the stability of a particular region than we are.
Mr. McGrath, any follow-on?
Well, you know, we have a We had the history of the country from 1787 to 1953 reflected this cycle of mobilized for war and then demobilized. We had this aversion to the maintenance of standing armies that was enshrined in our Constitution. That was, to some extent, one of the indictments made against King George III in the Declaration of Independence. But we tried to demobilize after World War II. We got then fairly quickly into another war that was the leading edge of the Cold War, and we then made this uneasy bargain with ourselves that we would be the world's leading democracy that also maintains a large peacetime standing army as a way of protecting the investments that we had made in freedom and stability in the world. That whole regime won. We had a great victory, and we had a great victory dance in 1989 and 1991. But the world did what it always does, and it changes, and it's presenting us with these new challenges. And I think we are going to enter a period now where we will have to consider again the value of a larger peacetime military establishment across the board. I've made a living in the past few years of advocating for sort of cannibalizing some of the Army to make the Navy more powerful, but I've begun to evolve on that to think that that's just stupid now, too. I mean, we just need a more powerful military across the board to prepare ourselves for great power dynamics as they will present themselves.
I appreciate you gentlemen indulging me in my geekiness for the broad strategic implications of various issues and the existential thought that goes with it. When we come back, we'll take a quick break. When we come back, I want to focus again on the testimony that you delivered to the subcommittee and focus on the potential solutions for the Navy. We'll do that when we return on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio. My guests, Brian Clark of CSBA and Brian McGrath of the Ferry Bridge Group. We'll continue in just a moment. Welcome back to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio. In your DoD report this afternoon, my conversation with Brian Clark of CSBA and Brian McGrath, Managing Director of the Ferry Bridge Group, continuing, and each of them testifying before the House Armed Services Subcommittee on Sea Power and Projection Forces on the role of surface forces in presence deterrence and warfighting. And Brian McGrath joining us from San Diego. Brian Clark in the studio with me. Mr. Clark, you write in your recommendations and your way forward to the committee and told them in this hearing, the Navy has a limited window of opportunity to establish a new framework for surface warfare. What's the reason for that? What makes this so urgent, Brian?
Right now, the surface Navy is in a situation where if it had to go up against a peer competitor Navy or even a Navy or a ground force that has capable anti-ship weapons, it would be unable to keep up with the number of weapons that the enemy would be able to launch at them. Those number of weapons would exceed their defensive capacity. And that's not a tenable situation. You can kind of see that playing out right now in the Gulf of Aden, where we've moved an aircraft carrier into the Gulf of Aden to assist in the maintenance of maritime security in that area. And that's in part because our surface ships don't have the ability to attack and destroy other surface ships, such as the Iranians and other countries have in that area that are potentially hostile. So we have to have an aircraft carrier in there to bring in air power to do that instead of the surface ships being able to do that for themselves. That's not the kind of situation we want to continue. Right now, the Navy has a number of decisions facing it over the next year that give it an opportunity to dramatically retool how the surface Navy is going to be equipped going forward. The new DDG 51 Flight 3 is going to be sort of decided upon, and the first one gets bought this next year. The final configuration of this follow-on frigate that's going to replace LCS is going to be decided upon. They're bringing in a number of new ships into the fleet, so they're incorporating this new afloat forward staging base and the mobile landing platform and the joint high-speed vessel. Those are all joining the fleet now. And then there's a number of new weapons and sensor systems like the Advanced Missile Defense Radar that are all being introduced here very soon. So the Navy's got some decisions to make about how they take these ships and systems and configure them in a way that improves the ability of the surface fleet to gain sea control against an enemy that's getting more and more capable.
There's a cultural element here that I want to come back to, Brian. But Mr. McGrath, you write, naval forces in general and the surface force in particular need to become less predictable and disaggregate in meaningful ways that cause an adversary to expend precious intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance resources in trying to locate them. It won't be enough to simply increase the weaponry on existing surface ships without operating them differently. That sounds like there's a cultural element to what you're suggesting as well.
So there's certainly an operational element. I mean, the unit of issue of combat power of the U.S. Navy is the carrier strike group, and it's in the which includes the air wing on the carrier. Over time, because there hasn't been a threat to the carrier, a sea control threat, as Brian appropriately pointed out earlier, the approach has been to sort of more closely pack in these surface ships underneath the protective cover of the aircraft carrier's air wing, such as, like, as he explained, as you see going on near the Strait of Bab el-Mandeb today. If we continued to operate our ships like that and went ahead and increased their lethality and increased their weaponry, put better missiles, long-range missiles on them, and ASW weapons such as Brian has described, you would really suboptimize that investment because the targeting involved in finding that carrier would then also find all those other ships, and it would really just be a math problem. How many missiles do I need versus how many ships? Whereas if these newly empowered, newly lethal ships were operating further away from the carrier, obviously with enough close to the carrier to provide the kind of defense for it that they provide, but these others were more widely dispersed, it becomes more of a problem for the other side. It's not no longer just a math problem. It's a finding them problem. They have to then allocate resources to the finding. Once they've allocated those resources, they have to allocate missiles to those targets, which then dilutes the number of missiles that you can fire on any one target. So there are all sorts of operational benefits that are conferred by operating in a more distributed fashion. But you have to do both. You have to make ships more powerful, and then you culturally have to operate them differently.
I think in addition, Mr. Clark, to the word distribution, which Mr. McGrath rightfully uses, I think diffusion is probably a word that's appropriate too. Is that fair to say?
Right, definitely. You want to diffuse or disperse the force in an effort to dilute the size of the attacks that are being able to be brought to bear. So if your enemy has 100 cruise missiles he could launch against you, but you all pack in pretty close together, then he could bring all 100 of those to bear on that package of small number of ships in mm-hmm. a small area. Whereas if you spread out, he's going to have to apportion those 100 missiles against 10 different areas, perhaps, and gives them a smaller attack size that maybe drives it down to the size where it is within the defensive capacity of the ships to protect themselves.
We just have a few moments left, gentlemen, and I'll start my final question with you, Mr. McGrath. Were there topics or subjects or elements of your testimony that the committee didn't take on that you thought maybe they would or should have?
Well, I think, first of all, it's an incredibly collegial gathering, which I appreciate. I certainly would never like to be on the receiving end of something that was non-collegial. The Navy has a cruiser modernization program where they'd like to take some cruisers offline and bring them and modernize them and bring them back over time in order to sort of fill a hole in the total number of ships that would invariably happen if we just kept operating these ships to the end of their service lives. There's a little bit of a difference of opinion between me and the committee, and to some extent Brian and the committee, on how to implement this program, over how much period of time, over how many ships at a time can be taken out. But it really was a marginal discussion compared to the level of coherence that we had with the committee.
Mr. Clark, anything that we were surprised that you didn't get a chance to cover or that you thought the committee would probe on and they decided not to?
Definitely. The new frigate that the Navy is going to be developing, which is the follow-on to the littoral combat ship, we didn't really even address it in the hearing that much, but it's a highly controversial subject, I guess, because the LCS has been derided since its inception for various reasons. And so part of the rationale by developing a new ship to replace it was to deal with some of the problems that it had, lack of lethality, its unclear mission focus, et cetera. One of the things in my five steps that we talked about was we need to be able to take some of the defensive missions off of our cruisers and destroyers, which should be our offensive ships. They should be out there doing these offensive missions to kill enemy ships, aircraft, and submarines. One of the things we can do to take those defensive missions off them is make the frigate able to do air defense for escorting logistics ships and convoys and the kind of stuff you saw during World War II and the Cold War, where we would have a frigate go out and escort a bunch of ships in a moderate threat environment to keep them from being an easy target for the enemy. Mm-hmm. So otherwise, we're going to have destroyers and cruisers do that. So the frigate has to have an air defense capability, which means it might have to have the vertical launch system installed as opposed to being just a ship that's got some offensive cruise missiles, which doesn't do much for taking the defensive load off of your cruisers and destroyers.
There's a lot more to this conversation. I wish we had time to continue, but both of you, I'm very grateful for your time today. Brian, it's great to have you here in the studio. Brian McGrath, thank you for joining us from across the country. I appreciate your time, both of you, today.
Thank you, Francis. It's been great.
Pleasure. Thank you.